I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi, my lovelies. Thanks for joining me today. Today's case was coined the biggest scandal in the history of British justice. And that's a pretty high bar to achieve when you consider the fact that even on this channel, I've covered quite a lot of corruption and quite a lot of scandals that have plagued the British justice system. And today's is one that certainly does seem to be appropriately named the biggest scandal in the history of British justice. Don't get me wrong, there are quite a few on par with it, but it really is one that just makes you go, what was going on in the police officers' minds? Genuinely, you'll get more of this as I unravel, shall we say, what is going on in this case. And it makes you just sit back and go, my God, can I trust the authorities? I know that there'll be police officers watching who are amazing. I know that there'll be people in the services who would do everything they could to make sure that justice prevails. But there are some bent people, aren't there, as well? And the problem is when you get more than one bent person operating in an organisation, maybe together, well, things can go a little bit on the wrong side. And in this case, that is definitely what happened. So let's talk about poor Lynette Deborah White, who is the person who matters most in this case. She is the victim. And when there is a miscarriage of justice, the victim is the person who essentially is refused justice, because no victim, alive or dead, would wish for the wrong people to end up incarcerated, because it's a miscarriage of justice towards them and it's a betrayal of respect towards the victim. And so fitting people up, for example, because it's convenient to deal with figures where reporting and solving crimes are concerned, that's not what any of us want. We'd rather not have somebody put down in the prison system than have people who were incorrectly charged and put down in the prison system. It's as simple as that. So this case highlights just how badly cases can go wrong when the wrong people are investigating. And also when the wrong people are willing to corroborate with others who are doing wrong to ensure results that are false, but also impactful for individuals on a complete life-changing level. So like I said, Lynette White, she's born on the 5th of July in 1967. She's born in Cardiff in Wales, lovely part of Wales. She was described as a really young, smart and bubbly, beautiful girl. She was one of those people who didn't have a perfect experience educationally, and she struggled to some degree. She left school at 14. She had no qualifications and she had limited opportunities because of that. So she sadly ended up working as a sex worker. And let's be clear, when we're talking about very young people, that's not an empowered state. And I know that these days, with the crazy world of OnlyFans, where you have people like Bonnie Blue and other individuals in that sphere lying about the empowerment that women feel sleeping with 100 random guys in 24 hours and so on and so forth, that people can look at sex work and see it as something that a woman feels liberated enough to do. That's not what we're talking about when it comes down to a young girl who ends up in sex work because she doesn't have other options as far as she's concerned. It's a sad state of affairs when young people in this way end up being sexually exploited. And that is inevitably what happens. And don't get me wrong, I've brought in those OnlyFans girls because I personally think that the message that is going out there right now and the pornification of our society is having really bad ramifications for women, not just in the UK, but just globally. And I think that we really need to think about moving forwards, not backwards, which really does seem to be what's happening right now in that space. And bear in mind, the reason I bring that in is because of domestic abuse rates going up, because of a disrespect towards women going up, because of misogyny increasing. And we all know on this channel, we're really pro-men because the vast majority of men are great and good. But I think that there is a whole monster of a push to get women to believe that to be truly liberated and free, you have to have sex with loads of different guys. And I just find that really concerning. That aside, what happens is that she ends up in sex work And acquaintances of hers said that Lynette was basically the first girl out at lunchtime, the last one who leaves at night. She'd even work on Christmas Day. So yes, she's doing sex work, but she's obviously very committed to making sure that she's bringing in money. Apparently she earned around £100 per night, which is just devastating. When somebody's working so hard and that's what they're pulling in for selling their body, it demonstrates how cheaply women are conceived of in that space, in a lot of areas per se. I know that we hear about OnlyFans and escorts who earn a lot of money, but that isn't the experience for most sex workers. Now, by 1988, she's literally working every single day to pay for her boyfriend, Stephen Miller, who's known as Pineapple, because he's got this really high-level cocaine addiction and he wants the drugs, so she has to sell her body to go about making sure that she gets them for him. Now, of course, Miller isn't your typical boyfriend. We're not talking about a guy who's got a few issues but still buying her roses, taking her out for a meal on a Saturday night. No, the classic scenario here is he's also her pimp. And she is his only source of income. So basically, he takes everything from her and she's the person who has to exploit herself in that way. Now, they live together in a flat on Dorset Street and he would apparently take about £60 to £90 from Lynette each day. Bear in mind, she was only making £100 a day. He would drive her to Riverside in Cardiff. This is where she'd work. And then he'd meet with her at the North Star Club at the end of the evening to collect his money. I wish that Pineapple could, I don't know, be chopped up and ingested like a pineapple. At least he'd have a shred of use in this world. Genuinely makes me devastated to think that there are men still today out there exploiting women in this way. And we know what happens if a woman doesn't go ahead and come through with the goods that they want. She's going to get a beating. She's going to get a kick in. It's as simple as that. People are with pimps because, first of all, there is a power dynamic. Psychologically, you see the pimp as your protector, and when you're in sex work, you need a protector. So you get bought into this bias belief system where you think, well, what will I do without? Secondly, you think, well, if he's not going to do it, somebody else is going to come and do it, so it's better the devil I know. And thirdly, you're scared to death because bad things are going to happen to you if you dare to disobey. And that keeps you captured in that trap. And it's incredibly powerful to be in that coercive relationship. Now, during this time that Lynette is living in that area, Paul Coombs and Ian Johnson are also renting rooms in the same house. And they notice that they haven't seen Lynette for a period of time. And in fact, they say that they'd last seen her on the 9th of February, 1988. And Paul said that Lynette was really in a situation where she was constantly complaining that she was upset about the fact her boyfriend was taking all of her money that she's earning. Also, he said that he regularly saw her and became really worried when she suddenly wasn't there because he's thinking to himself, she's got these issues in her life. She's talking about the discontent in her relationship. Now she just seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. And this guy's clearly a good guy because as opposed to just accepting that she's disappeared, and let's be clear, sex work has a lot of transience. So lots of sex workers disappear and people don't necessarily see it as notable because it just goes with the territory. But this guy is really disconcerted by the fact that she's no longer present. So he starts making his own inquiries and he's asking other sex workers who Lynette worked closely with on Crichton Street whether they've seen her. Now, one of these women is Leanne Vilde. She'd actually loaned Lynette the keys to 7 James Street. Now, this is a really rundown flat that was used for clients. And Leanne at this point thinks to herself, God, I haven't seen Lynette either. I need to try and get in contact with her. And that's what she does. She tries to find out where she is, get a hold of Lynette, but she can't. And then she can't get into the flat herself. So now she's really concerned. So we get to the 14th of February, 1988. At this point, Lynette hasn't been seen by Leanne for 6 days. So Leanne thinks, you know what, I'm going to go and see whether I can get into the James Street flat. She asks a taxi driver, a guy called William Diamond, who knows both Lynette and Leanne, and says, can you take me to the address? I'm needing to check on a friend. She also manages to persuade another tenant who lives at the same building to drop a spare set of keys from their window so that she can then let herself in through the main door. Now, she still can't enter the actual flat because Lynette had the keys. So at this point, she looks through the letterbox and she just knew something's wrong. First of all, she saw that the kitchen door was closed. And even though that could be just something that had occurred, for her, it was unusual. It was always left open. It was secured by a rope tied to the handle. So why would it be closed? So at this point, she thinks, something really has happened. She goes to Boot Town Police Station. She then speaks to PC Simon Johnson and says, listen, my friend Lynette's missing. I'm worried about her. I'm worried that she might be in his flat. And PC Johnson then tells Leanne, yeah, I'm actually aware that Lynette's a missing witness. So she's not just a missing person, she's a missing witness. She'd actually been due to be called as a witness for the prosecution in two trials. Now, the police, because of this, believed that she was just trying to avoid the whole situation of going and giving evidence. So she was essentially lying low to avoid going to court. Now, the first trial that she was meant to be given evidence and testimony about was against a woman named Francine Caudill. And she was up for an allegation of attempted murder, which is obviously a very serious offence. The second was against Robert Gent and Eric Marasco. Again, this was a very serious offence. They were charged with attempting to procure the services of a 13-year-old girl for sex work, which is obviously heinous and deserving of a very severe punishment. But you can understand, for Lynette, who's also a sex worker, the idea of going into court and giving evidence and being cross-examined by barristers who are just going to make you seem like a really terrible person for your lifestyle choices, that could be really overwhelming. And it could make sense to the police that she would just want to avoid doing that. Now, it turns out the police had literally, because of this, been actively searching for her all weekend. And a judge had issued a warrant for her arrest because they wanted her to be at those trials. Now, that trial was meant to begin on the 15th of February 1998, and it was meant to begin at Cardiff Crown Court. But of course, no one could find Lynette. So because of this, PC Johnson, another officer called PC Anthony Prosser, and PS William Bisgood, they obviously have a motivation now to go to the flats at St. James's Street, because they're thinking to themselves, well, maybe she is there. We've got a warrant out for her arrest. We needed to give evidence at court. So it kind of kills two birds with one stone. We've got people worried about Lynette going missing, and now we have the perfect opportunity to see whether she is or whether she's choosing just to hide out. They get to the flat, and they end up getting forced to kick the flat door down. And actually, they do find Lynette. But it's not because she's lying low. It's because her body is in the bedroom of that flat, lying on her back, suffering massive injuries. They know that she's dead the moment that they see her. Now, that bedroom where they found her, it contained one bed, no other furniture. And Lynette was basically discovered between the foot of the bed and the window. She was still fully clothed. She was actually just missing one shoe. And straight away, the police could see there was lots of blood at the base of the bed. It was on the carpet. It was on the walls of the room. But there was very little blood on the mattress. They did see that there was an open but unused condom that was present too. Now, when they did the forensic examination, they found 150 different sets of finger and palm prints in the flat, which makes sense, let's be honest, when you're a sex worker and there's multiple sex workers using an environment, there's going to be a lot of people's prints, right? But that's a lot of analysis to go through and also a lot of people to potentially exclude in an investigation. When they look at Lynette's body, it's harrowing what's happened to her, because it turns out her throat had literally been cut from ear to ear. And to just describe this, it meant that the cut was so deep, it exposed the bones of her spine. There were also multiple stab wounds to her chest, to her breasts, along with wounds to her face, her stomach, her arms, her wrists, her inner thighs. She also had defensive wounds to her hands. And you can imagine, can't you? That's a frenzied attack. And it speaks of somebody with a rage towards this woman. And I don't think it's the fact that there was a rage towards Lynette as an individual. I think it was a rage towards Lynette as a female. And the feelings that this person has about females and the projection in that moment of rage onto that victim that basically demonstrates the feeling that he had towards women, which is that they are lesser beings and that he wanted to dehumanize and destroy the body. When Bernard Knight carried out the autopsy on Lynette, he was somebody who'd actually served as Home Office pathologist from 1965 to 1996, so a very, very experienced pathologist. He'd actually been involved in lots of really high-profile cases, including actually those of Fred and Rose West. And he did that autopsy and described Lynette's murder as a, quote, mutilating attack with sexual overtones. I think that when a woman is murdered and they are stabbing the breast area and the inner thighs, like I said, you can automatically connect the rage that that person is feeling on a sexual level. So maybe they struggle to reach sexual climax, or they don't feel aroused at moments where they desire to feel aroused, and it becomes something that makes them so insecure and makes them feel so inferior that in the moment where they bubble over into that kind of attack, it comes not just from the physical, but from the psychological and emotional. And that's why it's so rageful, and that is why it's so dehumanizing. That autopsy identified a total of 69 wounds. 69. She was stabbed 7 times in the heart, which is overkill completely. And that pathologist concluded that she was killed via the wound to her throat. He said it would require considerable force because the skin, muscles, larynx, and voice box had been cut right down to the neck bone. He actually said that her head was likely forcibly held back to inflict the wound, which must have been absolutely terrifying for Lynette. The pathologist believed that the murder weapon was at least 5 inches long. And one of the 2 t-shirts that Lynette was wearing was literally absolutely lacerated, just shred to pieces. The pathologist determined that Lynette died between midnight and 4 a.m. in the early hours of the 14th of February. Actually, her watch had stopped at 1:45 a.m. and the police believed that that was most likely the time of death. Now, they did recover a zoospermic semen that was present in both Lynette's vagina and in her underwear. Now, the pathologist determined that that had been left there within 6 hours of her death. Now, that doesn't automatically mean that that was the person who's responsible for her death. Of course, if you're a sex worker, you might have multiple partners, but at least it was something that demonstrated there was at least a lead. Now, when you talk about azoospermia, it's a condition where there's actually no sperm in a man's ejaculate. So that can be caused by a variety of actual conditions. So blockage in the genital tract that prevents sperm from entering to ejaculate. And that can be caused by things like surgery, like a vasectomy or other surgery or an infection or an injury. And it can also be caused by sperm production issues. So if the testicles are abnormal, can't produce sperm, that could be something like a genetic condition such as Klinefelter syndrome or a history of undescended testes. That's another reason that you'd have those problems. And then there's hormonal problems. So it means that the hormonal system isn't actually stimulating the testicles and genital tract to produce the sperm. And then there's always the possibility of things like recreational drugs, medical treatments like chemotherapy, radiation, or even something like a childhood illness, like viral orchiette. These are all things that could mean that you got that result. Now, when the police start speaking to witnesses, because obviously no one can figure out who's killed her, she's a sex worker, which means that there could be multiple suspects. And it's challenging when you have all of this forensic detail and information and you're looking for potentially just one person. So the police are starting off on the back foot. And also there's been a passage of time because she's been there for some time. And that means, again, that because there has been that passage of time, that all important 24 hours when a victim is found dead, it's passed because she's been in situ in that flat. So the police start interviewing people. They speak to Sylvia Leeshan. She's a woman who lived around the corner in a place called Louisa Place. She said, listen, I heard screaming. I heard screaming some point between 1:30 and 2 a.m., It lasted for about 5 minutes and it did actually appear to come from James's Street. She said, you know what? I didn't really worry about it at the time. If I'm honest, I hear people screaming all the time because people are leaving nightclubs and it's just people are loud and these things are going on. So it hadn't pricked her conscience to think there is somebody in distress. Then a woman called Nellie Heath, she was staying overnight with a cousin in Clare Street. She said, yeah, I was woken by an absolutely piercing sound of a woman. She screamed 3 times. I was frightened. It genuinely didn't sound like somebody was feeling around. Now, I don't know why you wouldn't call the police at that point, but I also know that a lot of people believe that somebody else will deal with it, that bystander interaction issue. But when we hear things like that, we should act, particularly if it's a female who's screaming at a point where she sounds like she's terrified. Now, the murder investigation was initially led by Detective Chief Superintendent John Williams. So from August 1988, it was then led by D.I. Mouncher. Now, as I said, In any kind of investigation, there is what is described as the golden hours. That's the 24 hours immediately following the discovery of a body. And the reality is that 24 hours that they track back, even though it's problematic because obviously she's been dead for 2 days, it still reveals absolutely nothing to identify the murderer. Also, the actual murder weapon's never been found. Now, bear in mind, we're going back to 1988 when this happens, and forensic use of DNA is really in its infancy. The primary scientific investigative technique is basically fingerprint examination. And let's be clear, you already know there was 150 prints and palm prints in that property. So it's challenging. And also, police are struggling to find any evidence as to which clients, if any, Lynette had actually been with that night. So she could have made contact with lots of anonymous men. And some of them could have been local to Cardiff. Some of them could have been visiting. So it's really hard to figure out where to focus. And 324 clients of local sex workers ended up getting identified. There was more than 3,500 house-to-house inquiries that were completed. Nearly 3,000 witness statements were taken. And actually more than 30 suspects were considered and then rejected. So even though we are going to criticise enormously what happens in the investigation, when it started, they really were doing that good old detective work, using the resources that they had for that time frame, because obviously we've moved on a great deal. 2024 is very different to the 1980s. But nonetheless, it started off doing that great detective work that we'd all expect. They also made a ton of appeals for information, and that was quite effective. So it led to several potential witnesses independently describing, firstly, a white male around 5'8 to 5'10 who would fit being around his mid-30s. They said he had dark hair, he had a dishevelled appearance, and also they said they'd seen this guy looking distressed near James Street in the early hours of the 14th of February 1988. Also, witnesses said that they'd noticed this guy had a cut on his hand and also blood in his clothes. So understandably, that does seem like a very good lead. The police then go about composing an e-fit of the suspect and they put it out there with the public. We get to the 17th of March 1988. DCS Williams ends up appearing on Crime Watch, absolutely infamous program in the UK. My friend Rav Wilding actually presents it nowadays, and it is just the stalwart of crime TV in the UK. And it's really been effective at jogging people's memories and solving crimes, even cold cases. So DCS Williams appears on it and he says that they genuinely believe the man in the e-fit was indeed Lynette's murderer. He said this man almost certainly had the blood of the deceased on him. Now, Lynette's last movements end up getting reconstructed for the programme. Again, very effective, jogs people's memories. She'd been last seen on the 9th of February 1988 in Dorset Street, Grangetown. This is after walking out on her boyfriend. And that would have meant that she had great sense because she should have walked out on that man. He was an absolute snake and he was a leech on who she was and her resources. Now, there was later a confirmed sighting of Lynette in Charles Street. This is on the 13th of February 1988. Now, whilst all of this is playing out, people are grieving, and Lynette's funeral ends up being on the 7th of April 1988. It was held at St. Patrick's Church in Grangetown, and actually there was over 200 people who attended, which demonstrates that whilst often people will refer to somebody as a sex worker, and as if that somehow validates that they place themselves in danger, and therefore can we feel as sorry for this person as we would if it had been a school teacher, the reality is yes, we can and we should. Lynette was a daughter, she was a friend, she was a colleague, she was all these things. Yes, she was also a sex worker, but people loved her. And for 200 people to come and turn out for a funeral, particularly a funeral that's so traumatic and tragic, it demonstrates the meaning that she had to her community. Now, the first significant development the police got was on the 4th of May 1988. At this point, the police are informed that scientists have found traces of foreign blood on Lynette's jeans and socks, which is great, because obviously this could mean that they can connect the killer at some point, even in the future. Also, they found blood on the skirting board in the bedroom. Now, this blood was found to be quite a rare blood type, AB. 2 weeks after this, scientists found blood on the jeans, and that revealed the presence of the Y chromosome, meaning that it had come from a male. So they have got some information potentially about the killer. But like I said, we're not where we are now on a DNA level. So not necessarily helpful in that moment in time. But it means often, as we know, that there are these individuals who've carried out horrible crimes and they think they've got away with it. But actually, it's just about time catching up with them. Now, we get to the 12th of February, 1988. At this point, there's a trial of Francine Caudle that commences at Crown Court. She was the one who'd been indicted for attempted murder and wounding with intent. So she was facing a significant sentence if she was found guilty. Now, Francine, she denied the allegation. And bear in mind, Lynette was a prosecution witness in that trial. So that's why the arrest warrant had been issued, because the Crown had believed that she might not show up to give evidence. Now, it turned out that Lynette wasn't actually present for the crime that Francine was on trial for, but she had been due to give evidence of a similar incident which had taken place a few months earlier, and she'd actually personally been stabbed in the shoulder by Francine with a knife. It seems like Francine's a little bit on the stabby side. Now, due to this, Francine Caudle was initially a prime suspect in the murder investigation, along with her brother, a guy called Richard Caudle. Also, her mother, Helen Fruger, was also implicated. So at this point, Francine's trial had been halted because Lynette's body had been discovered. Now, she was tried again in May 1988, and then she ended up getting convicted for wounding without intent. So they obviously couldn't pin the crime on killing Lynette, but she was charged and convicted with wounding without intent. Now, the police then think, okay, well, if it isn't her, who else could it be? So they look at a second potential suspect, and they considered that Lynette was afraid of Stephen Miller, who obviously was her pimp and also the person that she was apparently dating. So they suggested that she was afraid that she hadn't earned enough money to give him. So he then gets questioned at the beginning of the investigation, which we would all expect to happen because you are closely related to the individual who's died, and also there's an issue within your relationship, such as you're the pimp, you're going to be a suspect. So he ends up getting picked up by police in the early hours of the 15th of February 1988. He does give a statement and he has an alibi for the suspected time of Lynette's murder, so he ends up getting released without charge. So at this point, the police publicly announce he's ruled out of the investigation. Now, when Miller's first taken for questioning, he was actually still wearing the same clothes as the day prior, which was at the time of the murder. And the police even joked during the interview that he should sit in the opposite corner due to the smell of his clothes. So he was wearing those clothes the day of the murder and he's wearing them at the interview. There's no traces of blood found on them. They also search his car, yields nothing. His blood type wasn't AB, and the police were able to corroborate his alibi with David Orton, who gave a statement about Stephen's whereabouts. So he's ruled out completely. Then there was a suspect called, mysteriously, Mr. X. So on the 20th of April, 1988, DC Jeff Thomas puts together a list of 12 suspects. They're basically put together based on criminal history. One of the men, who was left anonymous, was referred to as Mr. X. Now, it turned out he was a convicted sex offender and paedophile who lived a 20-minute drive from James Street. He was also known to regularly use sex workers. He visited Cardiff a lot. He also had a history of mental illness. He was also classified as a psychopath. So he sounds like a delight. Convicted sex offender, paedophile, and psychopath. Just casually walking around the streets of Cardiff. What's to worry about there, chaps? Now, when he was questioned, he did admit that he'd paid Lynette for sex in the past. He also had no alibi for the time of Lynette's murder. He also had blood type AB. Now, he's interviewed by DC Paul Fish, and DC Paul Fish believes that had Mr. X been pressed further, as far as he was concerned, he would have confessed. Now, on the 19th of October 1988, D.I. Graham Mouncher placed Mr. X under surveillance for 3 days. But by the 25th of October, the police were so convinced he was the killer that they actually continued surveying him until the 7th of November. On the 9th of November 1988, after they put all these resources into Mr. X, DNA analysis eliminates Mr. X from the investigation. So again, seemed like a good fit, had a history, certainly was somebody, I don't know, that we would all possibly like locked up anyway, but it isn't their guy. So then they have to narrow the suspect list. So they collect thousands, and I mean thousands, of statements from door-to-door inquiries and interviews. Now, Their prime suspect at this point has obviously been cleared. So the police return to all of those statements that have been given to go through them so they can continue their investigation. And we get it. There's nothing more frustrating than when you're doing an investigation, you think, I've got them. This is absolutely my man or my woman. And then you realise you got it wrong because you've spent a lot of time, a lot of resources, and you had hope. And it's really upsetting when you've got a dead young woman and she's been killed in such a brutal way. That could indicate that more killings could take place, because when you see a killing like that, you're thinking this is a potential serial killer without a doubt, because it's so attacking, so dehumanizing, so aggressive that you can't imagine that somebody with that level of rage is not going to spill over and act in this same way again. So they're on a time limit as far as they're concerned. And also, the local community is distressed and they want somebody brought to justice. So all of those pressures are certainly happening to the police. Now, when they go through all of these records, all these interviews, all of these investigations they've done so far, and look at who's said what, two groups of key witnesses emerged. Now, the first and the most important group of witnesses included Leanne Vilday, Angela Salia, and Mark Grommet, and Paul Atkins. So Leanne, she was in a relationship with Ronald Actie, and she was staying with her friend, Angela Salia, while the flat at 7 James Street was, as far as she was concerned, uninhabitable. Yes, she was letting Lynette Goh use it, but it wasn't really fit to live in. Now, Angela's flat was just 75 metres away from St James's Street. So that group is later referred to as the Core Four. Just bear that in mind. Paul Atkins and Mark Grommet, they both knew Mr. X. Mark, he lived in the flat immediately above where Lynette was murdered. Mark was a DJ at the North Star Club in Cardiff, and also that's frequented by Lynette and Leanne. Both of these guys had previous convictions for petty crimes. So they didn't have any kind of crimes that were very symbolic of sex attacks, but nonetheless, they had a history. Now, both men initially gave alibis for the time of the murder. On the 26th of April, however, under, what shall we describe it as, intense and immense pressure from the police, Paul Atkins then gives a statement saying that Mark Grommet has killed Lynette. And then he gives a confession saying that he killed her also, that he was the person who did it instead. So the police have now got this confession. But bear in mind, this is after, shall we say, pushing him for a period of time. Now, Paul Atkins first stated that Mark Grommet had gone to the flat to have sex with Lynette. He says then he hears a scream. Atkins goes and investigates, sees Grommet leaving the flat covered head to toe in blood, and he's carrying a knife. And Atkins then says, even though he's said that he's seen all this play out, that actually he'd met Lynette himself in the Custom House pub. Then he'd gone back to the flat to have sex with her. Then he wrestled her to the floor, sat astride her and stabbed her. So that statement itself contained four entirely different accounts. So it wasn't treated seriously at that point, because this guy's just saying everything and anything, and there's no coordination, there's no systemic understanding of what actually played out. It just sounds like he's just saying words and incriminating himself and others, but it's not playing out in line with what actually happened at the scene of the crime. And then the police also have suspicions about Leanne Vilday, who was letting Lynette use her flat. They'd been concerned apparently about Leanne from the beginning, because they suspected that she actually knew that Lynette's body would be found in 7 James's Street. So when she took police officers there saying that she was worried that something had happened to her, they said that they believed that that was because she knew she was dead. So on the 14th of February, she'd basically constructed this situation so that they would find Lynette's body with her present. Now, Leanne said, I absolutely did not know that Lynette's body was there at all. At the end of the day, I took you there because I thought she was missing. But guess what, guys? She happened to also be placed under significant pressure during her interviews. During the first 6 months of the investigation, Leanne made a total of 16 witness statements. In none of them, not one of those 16 witness statements, did she implicate anyone or say that she had any knowledge whatsoever of how Lynette died. So she was consistent in those interviews. However, we get to the 17th of May 1988. Leanne's drunk, inebriated in the North Star Club. She's having a conversation with a woman named Maxine Campbell, and other people can overhear what they are talking about. Now, during this conversation, she happens to name Stephen Miller and Yusuf Abdullahi as Lynette's killers. So on the 31st of May, Maxine goes off and makes a statement to the police about that. The police then understandably speak to Leanne, and Leanne says, yeah, you know what I did, but I was just really drunk. I'd taken speed. I wanted to get at Miller because I hated him for the way he took money off Lynette. But even though she was saying this is just all me making it up, the police still treated Miller and now Abdullahi as suspects, even though Miller had been ruled out right at the beginning. Then we get to the 15th of June, 1988, and police are so desperate, they interrogate Leanne under hypnosis. Just a bit of hypnosis. Sorry, what do you want to do? I just want to do a bit of hypnosis. Just look at this, look at this, look at this, you're under. You know, I get it. People do use this in investigations. I find it a little bit worrying, genuinely. Because just because somebody puts you into a deep state of relaxation and your unconscious or subconscious can at times answer questions, you don't know where that's coming from. Literally, you put people under hypnosis for regression and they tell you that they're Cleopatra. Do I believe it? No, I don't. And the reason I don't is because you can't have more than one Cleopatra, and I've heard of about 5,000 Cleopatras under regressive experience. So like I said, it worries me a little bit. But that hypnosis is conducted by Dr. Una Maguire, and they said that Leanne was really cooperative, but she'd witnessed nothing. She couldn't help with the investigation. So again, that confirms what she's saying. I was just making it up. I was a bit pissed off and I made it up. Now, Yusuf Abdullahi, he had been questioned as part of routine door-to-door inquiries at the time of Lynette's murder. Now, bear in mind, Yusuf had already been questioned. This was part of routine door-to-door inquiries. And actually, just to throw out there, at the time of Lynette's murder, he was working on board the ship MV Coral Sea. That was 8 miles away in Barry Docks. He was present on that ship. Now, unfortunately, unaware to him, his wife at the time, Jackie Harris, was having an affair with Jeff Smith, who also happened to be a South Wales police officer. And his brother-in-law, a guy called Ronnie Williams, was also a police informant. Yes, I'm imagining a very challenging ménage à trois in this moment. Now, it turns out that Ronnie, the informant, begins passing information to the police in March 1988. Now, bear in mind, most of it's inaccurate, most of it's unreliable. And this includes a claim that Lynette had been stabbed in the Casablanca Club in Bluetown before being carried to the flat in James Street, which was clearly untrue. But this is the information he's putting over. Now, initially, Ronnie claims that Yusuf knows the identity of the killer and is concealing this information, and later begins to suggest that actually Yusuf was directly involved in her murder. So this story is changing and changing and changing. Also claims that Yusuf had been able to leave work at the Coral Sea without his colleagues being aware. Now, this is just hearsay. This is just somebody saying stuff and the police potentially taking it seriously. For example, there's no evidence whatsoever that he left the Coral Sea at all, but apparently this guy's saying it's the case and the police are listening. It's also well known in Cardiff that Yusuf and Ronnie literally detest each other. So Ronnie's got some skin in the game here when it comes down to identifying Yusuf as somebody who may have probable cause to have killed this person. Now, Angela Salia, she was actually described in this case as one of the most vulnerable members of Cardiff society. And bear in mind, guys, she has an IQ of 55, and that is incredibly low. So that is somebody who is developmentally challenged on a range of levels. Now, the police end up questioning Angela on the 17th of November, 1988, and basically insist that she's connected to Lynette's murder. She, on that day, just gives multiple statements to the police. The first two statements, she claims that Stephen Miller had visited her at 1 a.m. on the 14th of February, 1988, looking for Lynette. 2.5 hours later, she gives another statement saying that she saw Stephen Miller, John and Ronnie Acty, Yusuf Abdullahi, Tony Paris and Tony Brace, who are all bouncers as well from the North Star Club, outside 7 James Street. She also then goes on to say that she claimed to have heard screams from the flat and saw Ronnie Acty talking up to someone in the window of one of the flats before being let into the building. Then the second group of witnesses, so not as important as that first group, but nonetheless those who brought information to the police. They include Pamela Matthews and Violet Perriam. Now, Pamela Matthews, she lived at 18 St. Clair Court, which is next door to Leanne and Angela. She reports that she'd seen Angela acting suspiciously outside her flat during the early hours of the 13th of February 1988. And she said that she saw Angela disposing of something in a rubbish chute at St. Clair Court while looking scared and nervous. On the 1st of November 1988, Pamela then changes her statement and says, no, actually, this occurred on the 14th of February, not the 13th of February. She also says to the police, I think that Angela knows more than she's telling you. Then we have Violet Perriam. That statement that she gave was that she was actually somebody who worked as a receptionist at the Blue Town Health Centre. She also was a social secretary at Cardiff Yacht Club, so she knows a lot of the local community. And she said on the 10th of November 1988, that's the day after Mr. X has been cleared, Violet had given this statement to the police. She said that she'd been driving home from a club and she passed 7 James Street around 1:30 a.m. on the 14th of February 1988. She claimed she'd seen 4 black men arguing outside the building. She apparently recognised 2 of them as John Acty and Rashid Omar. Also said that Stephen Miller was not one of the 4 men. So now Stephen Miller, who's being said to be there, is now being identified as not being there. Now, John Acty, he had been involved in the door-to-door inquiries about the murder. He told the police that on the 14th of February, he had gone to the Casablanca Club around midnight and they'd left around 3:30 a.m. For some reason, Perriam's statement was literally hailed as the breakthrough needed by the police, gave police basically a whole host of these new suspects to look into. So these new guys have all been identified or brought back into being suspects. Now, over the next 20 days, the events from this point move really quickly. So that Core 4, who are apparently bringing in all of this amazing new evidence, they end up giving multiple new statements to the police. And of those statements, the accounts are changing, then they're changing again. They range from saying that they'd seen absolutely nothing to agreeing that they'd seen Lynette murdered by 5 men. So we've gone from, I know nothing. So you know absolutely nothing. I know nothing. I've seen nothing. Are you sure you've seen nothing? I have seen literally nothing. I keep saying I've seen nothing. I know nothing. But can we just ask you whether you actually mean that you have seen nothing? I'm sorry, I'm confused. Are you saying that you want me to have seen something? Well, I mean, I'm not saying that you should tell me you've seen something, but if you just happen to have seen something, maybe anything, maybe 5 guys murdering somebody, that kind of thing, we'd like you to tell us. So you think that I should tell you that I saw Lynette murdered by 5 men? Oh, did you? Sorry? Did you see that? Did you see that? You just said that you saw her murdered by 5 men. Did I? Yes, yes, you said that. I've got it on tape. Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I did. I saw her murdered by 5 men. Literally, that's what was happening. Now, at the end of that process, of those statements, every single contradiction from their account was removed. Every single contradiction. So eventually, there seemed to be this amazing evidence to establish that 5 men, Stephen Miller, Youssef Abadali, Tony Paris, Ronald Acty and John Acty, had literally been outside or inside the 7 James Street flat when Lynette was murdered. Now, remarkably, by the way, guys, there was no evidence that any of the 5 men were even friends or even knew each other. But now they're all at James's place murdering Lynette. We get to the 7th of December 1988 and unbelievably, the police arrest Stephen and Tony Miller, Youssef Abadali, Ronnie Acty, Rashid Omar and Martin Tucker. On the 9th of December, John Acty and Tony Paris are arrested. Now bear in mind, of all of those guys, not one piece of forensic evidence has been found to link any of them with the crime scene. But why let things like evidence affect arrests? Now, 7 out of the 8 people who were arrested were black. 3 were released. But that kind of demonstrates potentially a bias towards those black men. And I know we're in 2024 now, and I appreciate that times have moved on and we have a really equal society in the UK and actually in the Western world on the whole, but certainly in 1980s, it wasn't that way. And if you were a black guy, you were far more likely to be identified as a potential suspect because you were seen as different. Like I said, we have a much more multicultural experience now, but certainly that was a problem. Now, Stephen Miller gets interviewed again. In fact, he gets interviewed on 19 separate occasions. And I'm not going to say for 1 minute he's a nice guy. We all know what he was doing to Lynette. But nonetheless, 19 separate occasions spanned 13 hours. During this period of time, he's denied access to a solicitor for at least the first two interviews, which is completely immoral and illegal. And also, it's worth noting he had a mental age of 11. He ends up confessing to killing Lynette after making, quote, 307 denials. Let that sink in. 307 denials, and then he admits it. Also, conveniently implicates the other four men. He's actually the only one of the suspects who actually confessed. At this point, he doesn't introduce any significant facts because he isn't aware, really, of what happened during the killing. So he's not adding any new detail to what the police already know. And he's not introducing things that a killer would know. So there is nothing that he's bringing in during being interviewed that he wouldn't have heard from other people or that wasn't in the public domain. But like I said, when they look at the crux of the information, there was certainly nothing new to add. And you would imagine that as soon as confessing to the killing, you would have a whole heap of extra things to add because you were the person there doing it. Now, on the 11th of December, 1988, five men get charged with Lynette's murder. Abdullahi, Stephen Miller, Tony Paris, and Ronald and John Acty. And they actually become infamously known as the Cardiff Five. Now, in early January 1989, Leanne, who obviously was the woman who let Lynette use her flat, she sends a letter to her friend Nicola Haysham. At this point, she says to her friend, listen, I've been manipulated by the police. She said they'd basically given her two stark choices. You either support what we're saying, support this case, give evidence against the Cardiff Five, or we're going to charge you with murder, which is a pretty harrowing scenario to play out in your world. And bear in mind, when you are going against the authorities, it's really challenging. So she's terrified. So she said to a friend in the letter, that meant I either say, yes, I was there, and I saw the five boys, and I got out of the police station that day, and then be a main witness in this fucking murder case, or the other option I had was to say the same as I said from the day I found the girl, which is the fucking truth, Nikki. I hope you believe me anyway. If I would have said what I've been saying for 10 months, which honest to God is the truth, I would have been in the dock for murder, Nikki. So I've lied to the police just so I could have got out of that fucking police station. Nicola, I was scared to death. And you can just hear it in that letter. She's terrified. She genuinely believed that she'd be up for murder. And also, what is that telling you about the corruption level of the police? How dare they strong-arm somebody in this way? How dare they get a false confession about things that aren't real? It's disgusting. So we get to the first trial that really shouldn't be happening because there's literally not a shred of forensic detail that connects the guys who were up for these charges. It's the 3rd of October 1989, it begins at Swansea Crown Court, and the judge is Mr. Justice McNeil. Now, the prosecution's case goes like this. They say Lynette's broken up with Miller on around the 9th of February 1988. This is because of his drug habits. He had no income of his own. He relies on Lynette's earnings to pay for his drug habit. And he's angry because how dare you leave me? How dare you abandon me? I want my drug money. That's their case. Miller, located at this point, according to the prosecution, the James Street flat via Leanne, and goes over in the early hours of Valentine's Day along with four other men to teach her a lesson. But apparently, the plan goes too far and Lynette's murdered. Now, I don't know about you guys. I get the prosecution's case, very emotive. It makes people angry. It makes the jury think they're disgusting. It makes them feel really upset about the fact that these men, and particularly Miller, have abused and used this woman. But the idea that they went around to just teach her a lesson and then she's been brutalised and knifed in all these different locations and her throat utterly cut. I mean, that's not going too far, is it? that's just murder. And again, it's a type of murder that suggests some kind of intimate rage. And yes, I understand that that's probably why they were trying to point the finger at Miller, even though they had no evidence and actually had an alibi. But in their minds, they're thinking, well, he's the obvious choice. But essentially, the idea that five guys go around and just decimate her body just doesn't make sense whatsoever. So the prosecution say this happens, and then the Cardiff Five, who don't actually know each other, they create this pact of silence. They just go, we'll never talk about this again. In fact, guys, we'll act like it never happened. So that's their argument. When it came down to the evidence, of course, we've got the testimony of the Core Four, who put all five men outside or inside St. James's Street at the time of Lynette's death. Also, they've got Stephen Miller's confession. Not all the ones where he denied it, just the confession. This was recorded, and then the tape is played for the jury. Now, as he confessed, all the jury had to do was to decide if he was telling the truth. And to try to discount the fact that the evidence from the defence would include the fact there was AB blood at the scene of the crime, what the prosecution did was say that the type AB blood belonged to Angela Salia. Now, that's impossible because she didn't have a Y chromosome. She's a lady, so therefore it couldn't be her. But they're not going to bring in that evidence in that way. They're going to do it in that, well, we know the reason that that isn't linked to him is because actually it's linked to her. And that's a way of getting away with why that blood is there. Now, the defence, they basically did a joint defence of all the five men. And they said, listen, the Core Four are lying. None of them were in the vicinity of James Street at the time of Lynette's death. Every single one of these suspects presented their separate alibis. None of the defendants had type AB blood. It could have come from none of those, so it came from somebody else. Nor was any of Lynette's blood or the type AB blood found on any of their clothes or the property. There was no forensic link to the scene or to the defendants. There was no fingerprints, no blood fibres, etc. There was a lack of fingerprint evidence, which you would imagine was absolutely crucial. And none of the witnesses stated that the defendants were wearing gloves. So why aren't the fingerprints or palm prints there if they weren't wearing gloves, which they weren't, according to the actual witnesses? So that seems like a pretty secure defence, doesn't it? Listen, you literally have these people saying this happened, but there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that what they're saying is true. Now, we get to the 26th of February 1990, and just before Mr. Justice McNeil, the judge, is about to sum up, he dies. Yeah, it was all too much for Mr. Justice McNeil, and he just checked out permanently. So at this point, the jury has to be discharged, and then a second trial is to be held in front of another judge. Now, there was a draft of McNeil's summing up, and in this he wrote, there is a suggestion that the evidence against each of the five defendants has been made up. There is not a shred of evidence that it happened. I mean, I'm just going to throw it out there, judge. You know, arguably, they've removed all the contradictions in the accounts and statements. They've coerced witnesses. They've intimidated people. They've entered inaccurate and wildly false evidence. But you're right, apart from that, everything is totally above board. So then we get to the second trial, 14th of May 1990, happens at Swansea Crown Court. Judge Mr. Justice Leonard presides over this. And now in the second trial, Leanne's letter that had been sent to Nicola Haysham, it's been disclosed to both the prosecution and defence in both the trials. Leanne says, oh yeah, I did write it. I did write that to my friend, but actually it was all untrue what I wrote, which makes no sense whatsoever, Leanne, with respect. It just sounds like they've got the screws on you again, doesn't it? Also, Angela Salia, when she was giving evidence, she actually says, listen, I did lie during the court proceedings. She said that at the police station, when she was making the statements, she basically said what she thought the police wanted to hear. She didn't want to get charged with murder herself. She thought she might do. And so she just wanted to say what she needed to say. Also, bear in mind, Jackie Harris, who is Yusuf Abdullahi's partner, you know, the one who was, I don't know, having the odd affair with a few people, or at least with one person who's a copper, or with some good links to the other coppers. Yeah, she gave evidence to the prosecution, and I don't think they'll have been calling into question her fidelity during that cross-examination, etc. So essentially, she is going against her own partner, and that's the problem, because a jury will believe that there must be something really broken about an individual if their partner is basically working for the prosecution. That's very powerful. Now, that second trial lasted just over 6 months, and it concluded on the 22nd of November 1990. At this point, Stephen Miller, Youssef Abdullahi, and Tony Paris are all convicted of Lynette's murder. Every single one of them convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. Now, the two acted cousins, they get acquitted. So at this point, they all become known as the Cardiff Three instead of the Cardiff Five. Now, just as Lynette's murders attracted nationwide attention, so do these convictions. There are loads of concerns being expressed about the fact that these feel unsafe. And in February 1992, a BBC documentary was aired suggesting there was a miscarriage of justice. No shit, Sherlock. It sounds like that's an appropriate investigation to have. And they question the objectivity of the police investigation and, of course, the credibility of their witnesses. Now, two witnesses who gave evidence for the prosecution, they make affidavits retracting their statements. So that's Jane Sandrone and a woman called Jackie Harris. Jackie at this point blames the police for supplying her with false accounts that she'd been given on the 8th of December 1988 when she said she overheard Abdullahi confessing to Lynette's murder. And other prosecution witnesses also made affidavits to retract their evidence and alleged malpractice against investigating police officers. So it's all kicking off, and rightly so. We get to December 1992. At this point, the appeal's heard before the then Lord Chief Justice Lord Taylor, Mr. Justice Popplewell, and Mr. Justice Laws. Sorry, but the name Mr. Justice Laws, it feels like he was born to be in this practice. Now, the Court of Appeal was not impressed, shall we say, with the quality of eyewitness evidence, particularly from Leanne Vilde and Angela Salia, who were the two really big witnesses in this case. So then they move on to considering Miller's confession. He had been in police custody for 5 days. He was interviewed for over 13 hours. They were recorded on 19 tapes, and Miller's solicitor was only present from tape 3 onwards. Now, on 1 to 7 of those tapes, Miller is strenuously denying being present at the scene, totally not involved. On tapes 8 and 9, there's a second team of police officers who start interviewing Miller. And at this point, he begins to accept that he was present at St. James's Street. By tape 18, he admits that Paris stabbed Lynette. On tape 19, he admits that he stabbed Lynette. Now, bear in mind, Miller denied being there or murdering Lynette over 300 times before making this apparent confession. In tape 8, he basically says, I'm just certain that I wasn't there. That's all. I'm certain I wasn't there, but it could happen. It could have happened. Officers then made it clear to Miller on many occasions that they're going to continue questioning him until, quote, they got it right. Now, on the tapes, it's clear that Miller's crying, is sobbing, is given no respite. And on the last tape, his solicitor actually intervenes. So that is disgusting. It's deplorable. It's terrible policing. And every single one of us who's hearing this information will be as appalled as one another. Now, Dr. Goodjohnson, he gave evidence on behalf of Miller. He said he was actually on the borderline of what he would consider was a mental handicap. He had an IQ of 75, a mental age of 11, and a reading age of 8. So very vulnerable when he's being interviewed. Should absolutely have had somebody with him to act as an advocate, not just his lawyer. We get to the verdict of this appeal. On the 10th of December 1992, Miller's appeal was allowed and his conviction was quashed. Lord Taylor said, "We are bound to say that on hearing tape 7, each member of this court was horrified. Miller was bullied and hectored, short of physical violence. It is hard to conceive of a more hostile and intimidating approach to officers where it concerns the suspect." The court also allowed at this point appeals for both Abdullahi and Paris. And Lord Taylor said the circumstances resulted from a combination of, quote, human errors. I think you're being a little bit generous there. I'm not saying it's human errors. I think it's coercion, false confessions and an absolute group of individuals who were willing to do whatever they needed to do to save their own skin, including lying about seeing a group of guys that they never saw. I think that's not human errors. I think that's human deception. Now, immediately after those appeals were granted, South Wales Police announced the investigation into Lynette's murder was not going to be reopened. Sorry? Yeah. We've realised that we got it completely wrong. Yeah, the guys who went to prison, they didn't do it. Right, so it's really important that we reopen the case. Yeah, we're not going to do that. Why? Nah, I just can't be bothered. At the end of the day, put a lot of resources into it. So got the wrong guys and now we're just going to like let it go and move on. Yeah, move on. Let's just let it go and move on. Said no one with a shred of conscience in this kind of investigation world ever. But that's what apparently happened at that point. We get to June 1999. This is 6.5 years after the appeals. South Wales Police, under duress, commissioned a review of the original murder investigation. So two retired Lancashire Constabulary senior detectives, William Hacking and John Thornley, they get instructed to examine the original investigation. Then there's a scientific appraisal that's led by Dr. Angela Gallup that involved basically the evaluation of all the forensic work. Now, Hacking and Thornley, they reported their findings in May 2000, and whoa, there were a lot of criticisms. And those criticisms included the exhibits officer had no training in her role and had never been an exhibits officer before. So what could possibly go wrong there? Who are you? I'm the exhibits officer. Oh, right. What's your job? Exhibits. Yeah, but what's specific? I exhibit things. Do you mean like in an art gallery? Yes. So what kind of experience have you got? I have none. I just like the word exhibits. Would you like to see my exhibits? Yes, please. I don't know what they are. I've got no training or qualifications. Honestly, that's literally real. Now, Mark Gromick's flat, that was flat 27 James Street, never got searched. Just never a bit of searching going on there. You know, in an investigation where people are going to get searched. No, didn't happen. There was apparently inefficient use of resources that were basically wasting time on low-level inquiries. It didn't get anywhere. They also found that priority was given to fingerprint examination, but they just ignored the blood examination. That report was 477 pages long, and they made 107 pages of recommendations. So those retired officers flew out of retirement and wrote basically War and Peace and indicated the failings were just enormous. And they stressed the importance of those foreign blood stains and the need to absolutely exhaust all scientific analytical possibilities, particularly with reference to DNA profiling. And they concluded that there was sufficient concern and evidence available to warrant a criminal investigation. They also recommended that the Core 4 be investigated as possible suspects, because it seemed like that Core 4 were willing to say anything to save their own skin. Now, fortunately, because of this report, on the 23rd of August 2000, the case gets reopened and it's nicknamed correctly Operation Mistrial. Now, they do further investigation of the foreign blood at this point. That's the forefront of their basic investigation. They find blood on the right cuffs of Lynette's jacket and sweatshirt, and it's compatible with the murderer pulling her jacket off one arm and around her body. Now, on the bottom of Lynette's jeans, they said there was blood there likely from dragging her body the short distance from the bed where it was found. On items and surfaces around Lynette's body, this is including cellophane wrapper, skirting board, cardboard box. Possibly the blood was there from repeated blows with a knife delivered with a bleeding hand. They also found blood on swabs taken on various parts along the exit route. This includes the inside of the front door. So that could obviously be from the killer walking away from the crime scene in the dark, because the flat had no electricity. It was in a state of disrepair at the time. And then they'd need to fumble to open the front door. So all of that contact information blood-wise is there. Now, there was no scientific evidence of anyone else having been at the murder scene at the time of the murder. And there was actually limited blood left at this point to be analysed, which is really, really important, because they know that if they can find who has this blood belonging to them, they have their killer. So at this point, they used forensic methods that weren't obviously available in 1988. And this manages to create a DNA profile of the killer. When they look on the National DNA database, they can't find them, so they haven't committed a crime that's notable, which means they're not stored on there. But in 2001 to 2002, the original defendants and the core four volunteered DNA samples, because obviously there's a potential now that they can actually be implicated or discounted. None matched the one from the murderer. So now they're thrown out of it. They then go through a painstaking process, basically of elimination, and they use a familial search of the National DNA Database. Now on this, the police find the DNA profile from the foreign blood of a 14-year-old boy that's similar. Now the similarity was so close that the male was likely related closely to the potential perpetrator. At this point, the police are able to narrow their focus onto the boy's uncle, a guy called Jeffrey Gaffer. On the 27th of February 2003, police are able to obtain a DNA sample from Gaffer. At this point, he tells the officers, "I knew Lynette. I had sex with her a week before she was murdered in the flat, the one in which she was murdered." So that in itself tells you Gaffer knew his DNA had been found in the flat. He's creating his defence. And he also said, "I thought you had the people for this." So you can just hear the way he's kind of fitting the jigsaw together. "Oh yeah, I did go and have sex at that flat. But you know, I'm an innocent guy. I was just using a sex worker. And also, this is really weird. You've got the people who did the murder." So very much trying to build that narrative. Now the police at this point are absolutely confident that Gaffer's the actual killer. So whilst they're waiting for the results of the DNA test, they're basically watching him because they want to check what his movements are. And the next day, what's he seen buying? A large quantity of paracetamol. So the police are now following him back to his home because they're thinking to themselves, he's trying to off himself. He's trying to get out of this by taking his own life. So they wait for a short period of time, then they force their way into his house, and he has indeed taken an overdose of paracetamol. He, at this point, is arrested. He's taken to the hospital. Then on the way to that hospital, he confesses to murdering Lynette. He said, "Just for the record, I did kill Lynette White. I've been waiting for this for 15 years. Whatever happens to me, I deserve. I sincerely hope that I die." Now, later in the treatment room, he told a nurse, "The reason they've been concerned is because I killed someone 15 years ago and they want me alive to go and stand trial." Then we get to the 4th of March, 2003. Gaffer's released from hospital. He then gets interviewed for the following 2 days. He declined to have a solicitor. He answered questions about his background. He accepted, for example, he was an introvert who hadn't apparently seen his family for over 9 years. He wouldn't, however, answer questions about how Lynette died. He then gets charged with Lynette's murder. He's remanded in custody. He later instructs 2 lawyers to represent him, and they were actually also involved in the original murder trials. So his solicitor who was appointed was Bernard DeMaid, who had represented Abed Ali, and the leading counsel barrister was John Charles Rees QC. He actually represented John Acty. So these two knew the case well. We get to the trial. On the 4th of July 2003, the sentencing takes place at Cardiff Crown Court, and Gaffer pleads guilty. He's then sentenced to life imprisonment. Now, there was mitigation brought forward. Rees QC made it clear Gaffer accepted full responsibility for murdering Lynette and that no one else was involved. So it always looks better if you say, "I did it." Just going to throw it out there, Gaffer. You've been free for a very long time. You didn't take any responsibility until the DNA had you. It's as simple as that. The blood don't lie. So it was worth him saying, "I accept this," because he was banged to rights. There was no way he'd get away with it. And he knows he's going to reduce his sentence, essentially. That's the only reason that he would do that. Now, what turns out happened is on the night of the 13th and 14th of February 1988, Gaffer had gone to Cardiff Docks to find a sex worker. He met Lynette, he paid her £30, he goes back to a flat at 7 James Street, then he changes his mind, according to him. He said he didn't want sex, he asked for his money back. She refuses, which you would understand. You've agreed to have sex with me, you've come to the flat, and now you're saying no. So he said that was his motivation. He takes out the knife he's carrying. He tries to intimidate her. Doesn't work. So Lynette, according to him, tries to take the knife from him. That wouldn't happen. We all know that wouldn't happen, but this is his story. And then there's this struggle. That wouldn't happen because Lynette was not a big person who would be able to take on a man. But this is his story. And then after that struggle, he stabs her repeatedly, horrifically, almost cuts her head off to some degree. And we're meant to believe this is just a struggle. It's an altercation that goes wrong. Now, Gaffer did in court accept that he caused the injuries that were depicted in the post-mortem photos. Also, this guy was 22 at the time of the murder. He'd been living in Cardiff in Mellifont Street above his sister and brother-in-law's shop where he also worked. So Mellifont Street is in Roath, which is a suburb around 3 miles from Bute Town. And after he murdered her, he moved outside Cardiff and basically became a recluse, which we have to take his word for, because he could very well have murdered other people. I mean, to go ahead and kill somebody in such a brutal fashion, that sounds like something within you that has an impulse and a compulsion to go ahead and destroy women. Now, Rees QC did say that Gafur acted alone and said, quote, "He is very sorry for the 5 men who were falsely accused of her murder, who stood trial, who were incarcerated for a long period of time, some for up to 4 years in prison. Although 2 of them were acquitted at the end of the trial and 3 were acquitted by the Court of Appeals 2 years later, those men have been stigmatised ever since. I want to say on Mr. Gafur's instructions that they had absolutely nothing to do with the killing of Lynette White. He didn't know the 5 men at all and had no connection with them." Well, I don't think those 5 men care. Yeah, it might quantify that they had nothing to do with the killings, but they knew that anyway. This guy let them rot. And if they had not had those appeals heard, if there hadn't been an outcry of support for these men, they would have carried on rotting until their sentences were finished. It's harrowing. Now, when it came down to sentencing, Judge Royce subsequently set the minimum term at 12 years and 8 months, which is insane. It's such a low bar, isn't it, when we're thinking about the death in the brutal manner that we've talked about of Lynette, and yet 12 years and 8 months is the minimum. Why not 30 years? The judge also noted the aggravating factor that Gafur allowed innocent men to be arrested, to stand trial, and to be convicted of a murder that he knew he had committed. That obviously is highly aggravating. Now, it later transpired that Gafur's plea of guilty was against the advice of his counsel. Rees wanted further time to examine whether or not one or both of the partial defences to murder, which is namely provocation or diminished responsibility, might be available. So he said that Gafur gave conflicting accounts, which included one that suggested others might have stabbed Lynette after he attacked her to make themselves look bigger over the people they were with. And at times Gafur said that there were people on the stairs above him when he left the flat. There was also a group outside. And he also said that he only remembered stabbing Lynette 12 times. So he was hoping to kind of get a diminished responsibility count there, or also to suggest that he wasn't the only killer. But Gafur had obviously thought, well, no, maybe it's time to tell the truth. Now, the Independent Police Complaints Commission, the IPCC, who very rarely actually do deal with complaints, so I'm going to say that now. I don't even know why they exist most of the time. But in November 2004, they announced it would supervise an investigation by the South Wales Police into the original police inquiry. I mean, it's only like a decade and a half late, but hey, why not do it now? Now, on the 13th of April 2005, 5 retired police officers get arrested in connection with offences of false imprisonment, conspiring to pervert the course of justice, and misconduct in public office, and rightly bloody so. 21st of April 2005, 4 more retired police officers get arrested in connection. Another 13 people were arrested in connection with evidence and information which they provided in 1988, which incriminated the Cardiff Three. On the 19th of May 2005, 3 serving police officers, that's a DC, a constable and a detective sergeant, were also arrested. Over that entire IPCC investigation, 30 arrests were made. Now, in February 2007, the Core 4, who gave all of that testimony and kept changing the statements and said that they were definitely there seeing these guys do the horrible things that happened to Lynette, they get charged with perjury. December 2008, Angela Salia, Leanne Vilday, Mark Gromit, they were all found guilty of committing perjury and sentenced to 18 months imprisonment, 12 months which were already served. The judge sentencing remarks said, "It's been submitted on your behalf, accepted by the prosecution, and I accept it myself. You were seriously hounded, bullied, threatened, abused, and manipulated by the police during a period of several months leading up to late 1988, as a result of which you felt compelled to agree to false accounts they suggested to you." They also said, as a judge, that perjury is an offence which strikes at the heart of the system of the administration of justice. Also brought in was the fact that uncontested medical evidence proved Paul Atkins was unfit to plead, so he should never have been allowed to plead anything. Now, in March 2009, the CPS actually had done their investigation to see whether there was enough evidence to prosecute 3 serving officers and 10 retired officers involved in the original murder investigation. And it turns out, yes, there was. So they were charged with conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. They also then got 2 other witnesses in the original trial, that's Violent Perriam and Ian Massey, and they also got charged with perjury. So there was a delay of 28 months from the decision to charge until the trial. Now, that trial took place with Mr. Justice Sweeney presiding over it at Swansea Crown Court. And to make it easier, the indictment was split into 2 trials. 10 defendants tried in the first trial and the remaining 4 in the second. So Mouncher, Powell, Page, Daniels, Jennings, Stephen, Greenwood, Seaford, Perriam and Massey, they're the first defendants. Now, during the first trial, there were a lot of concerns raised by the defence about alleged, quote, non-disclosure by the prosecution of relevant documents. On the 28th of November 2011, though, Judge Sweeney ordered the prosecution to actually produce a number of specific documents requested by the defence. 4 of the documents were found to be missing from their expected location. An investigation then concluded that these documents had been destroyed in 2010, on the instructions of Detective Chief Superintendent Christopher Coutts. So this meant the leading counsel for the prosecution, Nicholas Dean QC, was literally forced to close the prosecution's case. So on the 1st of December 2011, they stated, "I formally offer no further evidence and will invite my lawyer to direct the jury to return not guilty verdicts." So the trial collapses. And the South Wales Police are then referred to the IPCC for further investigation. Now, the decision was actually made at the highest level by Keir Starmer. He is our current Prime Minister, but at the time he was head of the CPS and the most senior public prosecutor in England. And Starmer said, "Prosecutions will stand or fall on the quality of disclosure, and failings can leave the court with no choice but to acquit defendants who have a case to answer." Now, on the 17th of January 2012, the missing documents, yes, the missing documents were found in DCS Coutts' office, still in the original box in which they'd been sent from the IPCC, bent as a 9-bob piece. Now, understandably, the public went crazy. Tom Mangold, the BBC journalist who covered the case of Panorama in 1992 and in 2012, called this the biggest scandal in the history of British justice. Also said that if the 13 accused Cardiff detectives had been found guilty, presumably all their previous cases, hundreds, would have had to be reopened and re-examined. Instead, they are now considering suing the South Wales Police. So by the time the trial collapsed, all of the police officers who had been charged had been allowed to retire, no doubt on full pensions. We get to February 2015. We have the then Home Secretary, Theresa May. She was also Prime Minister for a short period of time. She announced that an investigation into the collapse of the public corruption trial would be carried out, led by Richard Horwell QC. Theresa May also rejected calls for a full public inquiry. Why have transparency? Why, when there's lots of corruption? Let's just do it behind closed doors and pretend it will all go away. She said, "There are still unresolved questions surrounding the reasons why no one was found responsible for this appalling miscarriage of justice," but obviously she wouldn't actually make it in the public domain. Now, the inquiry was expected to present its findings in summer 2016, but this was delayed by civil action against South Wales Police. So the civil action against South Wales Police was following the collapse of the corruption trial because 8 former police officers and 7 other individuals sued South Wales Police for damaging their reputations. These are a group of not right officers who lied, who were corrupt, who were people who were making people make false confessions and threatening the individuals who were giving testimony, and they're suing because they think their reputations have been harmed, as opposed to it just being fitting because they're wrong-uns. So they alleged malicious prosecution and false imprisonment, amongst other things, whilst in public office by South Wales Police. We get to the 14th of June 2016, and Mr. Justice Wynne Williams ruled that the police was within its right right to investigate the officers and dismissed the case, thank God. They said, "I find it very difficult to understand how the accounts emerged as they did if no police officer was instrumental in what occurred. I've reached the clear conclusion that reasonable grounds existed from the start of the LW3, which is a police corruption investigation, to suspect that the untruthful accounts which the Core 4 gave about the involvement of the original defendants in Lynette's murder were brought about by criminal conduct on the part of the police officers involved. In my judgment, it was permissible for LW3 officers to suspect that officers who had been part of LW1 had engaged in a conspiracy to mould and manipulate evidence." Amen to that. Now, of course, Gaffer, who is the individual who went to prison for a minimum of 12 years and 8 months, was actually first considered for parole in 2016 and again in March 2018. Now, he's refused on both occasions. In 2020, Gaffer was moved to an open prison. That's 17 years after initially being jailed for the murder of Lynette. And at this point, a summary of a parole board hearing from the 21st of May 2021 stated that while Gaffer had been making progress since transferring to an open prison, COVID-19 restrictions prevented him making as much progress as he hoped. So obviously, they have some hope for him, but he hasn't achieved what it is they want him to achieve. Now, in total, Gaffer was denied parole on 5 occasions. Since 2023, however, he's been granted day release. And in October 2024, the parole board hearing confirmed Gaffer would be released. So they deemed his risk could be manageable in the community. Yes, ladies, manageable in the community. Sorry? So who are you moving next door? Oh, don't worry. I mean, he's an ex-offender, but he's fine. He's totally manageable. Yeah, like, but what did he do? Well, he did something that was mad, and that means that he was, you know, in prison for 17 years, but he's manageable. How manageable? Totally manageable. Totally manageable in the community. What did he do? Let's not go into the detail, because all you need to do living next door to this ex-offender is to know that he's totally manageable in the community. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to manage him in the community. Just chill out. It's bad, isn't it? It's really bad, actually. He brutally murdered a woman just out of the blue. And then he got all the guys sent to prison for it and took no responsibility until they had him banged to rights. But it's fine. We're going to manage him effectively in the community, like we always do. I mean, all you see in the news is how we do that really effectively. I'm pretty sure that with violent offenders, there's a really high return to prison because of more offending. Yeah. Just go with the manageable bit. Honestly. A spokesperson for the parole board said, "This is his 6th review by the parole board since the end of the minimum tariff period set by the sentencing judge, which expired in 2016. Parole board decisions are solely focused on what risk a prisoner could represent to the public if released, and whether that risk is manageable in the community." Went on to say, "The panel will carefully examine a huge range of evidence, including details of the original crime and any evidence of behaviour change." I mean, he couldn't murder anybody in prison who was female because the officers are protected to a degree and the rest of the people are male. And also, this kind of guy goes to hurt women because they're easier targets. But you know what? Sounds like you got it all boxed up with your amazing history of letting violent offenders out and then never being a problem afterwards. You know, crack on with that BS. There is a man walking the streets who had the capacity at 22 years of age to literally cut the throat and violently aggress with a knife a woman who did nothing wrong. Even according to him, if it was any kind of altercation, it was over the fact that he'd agreed a contract of having sex with her and it was going to cost 30 quid. So for 30 quid, he murdered her. And I don't believe that. I think he went with the full intention of killing Lynette because he just wanted to kill someone. But hey, sounds absolutely manageable, doesn't it? And also, just to finish, isn't it amazing that clearly they've acknowledged there is police corruption of the highest level, and yet because the corruption was so bad that the individual who was meant to hand over the information that would have meant the prosecution had a case and didn't do that, the case collapsed and there's been no further action. And those arrogant bastards, who were involved in the corruption felt they had a right to sue because of reputational damage. Well, here you go. You are an embarrassment to the force. You are an embarrassment to colleagues who work hard. You're an embarrassment to the authorities investigating crime. You are a disgrace and a blot on humanity. Each and every one of those officers who were charged, they should have been charged and gone down. They should have been tried appropriately in a court of law. Keir Starmer should have done something about that. But of course, this is a guy who does absolutely nothing for our country anyway. So it's just more of the same. Theresa May, also absolutely streak of piss when it came down to being helpful. Sorry guys, I can say that stuff on this part of my channel because you guys all come here for my extra content. It's been a long one, hasn't it? Sorry, there were just so many different moving parts. And I do agree with that journalist. It's been one of the biggest miscarriages of justice. I know it's been hard to follow because there are so many parts to this particular case, but it's really important that we give Lynette justice. And finally, she got it to some degree. But how worrying, how disturbing that this kind of killer gets to walk free from prison. Because I've got a belief that these kind of killers should never be freed under any circumstances. They are not individuals that can be managed because there is something unmanageable about their behaviour. And you know how I know that? Because Lynette got absolutely dehumanised, brutalised and carved up in a flat by him. Don't need to say any more. As ever, let me know your thoughts, guys, and I'll see you again next time. Take care.
Thank you, thank you.
Get Stephen.
It means everything. It means everything. I want to see my mother. I want to see my children. That's the only thing I want to do.
Stephen. They say when you're in a police station, you're supposed to have rights. They broke all the rules. They lied to me. They put me through sheer hell. I feel it. In my heart, I know what people feel like when they're being wrongly accused.
We were just basically just used as scapegoats for the police who couldn't find anything else or anybody else to put this crime on.
It doesn't matter what you've been in, these people they call police will find a way around it to do what they want to do, which is to get convictions to suit the hierarchy, put pressure on them. That's what it's really all about. Other people putting pressure on police to get convictions. They don't care who, anybody will do.